You're listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. This is episode 112 for mid-May 2018 of Simple Living Works podcast. We feature part three of our conversation with Susan Taylor of Just Money Advisors about her book, What About Our Money? A Faith Response. This part focuses on giving and investing.
So I'm wondering, have you ever written a short money autobiography? Or told another person how your views on money have been shaped in your life since childhood? Few people have, and few people talk in this way about money with even close friends or family. And then when it comes to giving money, sharing it, what feelings stir in you? Reluctance? Deep satisfaction? Do you talk with people about those feelings? How it feels for you to give in various situations? And then if you invest money, how do you feel about your investments? Most people have positive feelings when their investments gain more money, negative when they lose. But some people go a different path and invest money and their emotions primarily to bring more good to the world. These topics are all part of today's podcast. Please stay with us.
Greetings, Lee, from Sioux City, Iowa, and Simple Living Works.
And greetings, Jerry, from cloudy San Diego and Jubilee One Earth Economics. Today we're creating the last of three episodes based on your conversation, Jerry, with Susan Taylor, the economist, money advisor, an author, and a friend over many years here, she's such a colleague in this whole effort of thinking about money and economics and how we live our lives. In part one, we gave an extensive biography of her many achievements and involvements, and please check that episode to see her bio. The written bio also is in the written part of that episode. A lot of that bio was taken from Natural Investments website. Now, today, I'd like to share the bio that is part of her book that we're featuring in this series of three podcasts. And here's what it says. Susan K. Taylor has invested much of her life exploring the intersections of faith and money. Introduced to the connections between faith and money as a teenager, Susan wrote her first money autobiography, the exercise in this study's introduction, at a Faith and Money Network workshop shortly after arriving at graduate school at the University of Maryland, where she earned a PhD in economics. She weaves money and faith together in her own life as a mother of two, now young adults, a partner in Just Money Advisors, a financial planning and investment management company that specializes in socially responsible and community investment strategies, a regular writer on money and spirituality, vice president of Faith and Money Network's board of directors, treasurer for Kentucky Interfaith Power and Light, which mobilizes a religious response to global warming, and an active member in her Louisville, Kentucky church. So we're bringing you more from Jerry's conversation with Susan today. Today, the conversation grows out of chapters 5, 6, and 7 of her book. These chapters are full of delectable ideas about giving and sharing, about investing that makes doing good a higher goal than maximizing returns, and about connecting our money decisions explicitly with our faith. Well, let's go to the conversation between Jerry and Susan, previously recorded.
In your next chapter, Susan, you start moving towards solutions in a chapter called Giving, Stewardship of What is Ultimately God's. So talk about various forms of giving.
My intention was to address in a little bit a less conventional way, the one topic that churches do tend to talk about around money, and that's giving. So I was challenging the notion of the tithe being the only measure of whether we're giving enough, and really looking at much more, what do we need to be doing? What could we potentially collectively do with our money? What if we, as people of values, as people of faith, dealt with our own money issues enough to be able to let go of more money freely, to be able to feel like we have enough and can give more? What could we create together if we were willing to do that? And then address some about that, not only giving for service, for charity, but giving for advocacy, the real social justice work. And it's harder a lot of times for people who are giving away money to support more advocacy-focused projects, because it's so intangible and the results can be so much longer term. If you give to your local affordable housing trust fund, you may not see for years the difference that your money made. Or it may be that your money makes no difference, because you get into, when you get into the advocacy arena, it could be much more affected by policy. So you might never see, if your local metro government's not willing to support the low-income housing initiatives in some way, that any amount of money you throw at the trust fund may not get anywhere. It could be completely blocked. And that's, so it's harder for a lot of people, even people who have practiced giving for a long time, to wade into that advocacy realm. And I was making the case for why it's still important work to do and worth considering. And then to spend time in meditation and prayer discerning how much we need to give and where, so there's a more a deeper participation of the heart in where we give money. I like to make the case, you know, we often give out of a sense of what we're doing for other people. And that's true for both advocacy and service giving, that it's for someone else. But I really try to make the case that at least half of the need for giving is really our own. We need to be able to let go of some of our money. We need to be able, it's a, in response to a growing sense of security and provision, and in response to our connectedness with the wider community of people outside ourselves and how we can participate with them through giving in a way that benefits us as much as it benefits them, to try to create some detachment from the grip that money can have on our hearts and our lives. So that's where I tried to go with that chapter.
Well, I'd like to give you a personal example, and you're welcome to respond to it. In our family, and my spouse and I are looking forward soon to our 50th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
We've had over many years of discussions and negotiations and compromises, come up with a plan whereby we do give, we have the tithe or 10% as our base, And then above that, we each have our own pots of money, which we have euphemistically called our hobby money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can give away up to $100 without even asking her. And she can give away $100 without even asking me out of her hobby money.
Mm-hmm.
And part of this is because she is really good at giving her time. She volunteers a lot. She's just a remarkable person. She has a real hard time giving away money. I have a relatively easy time giving away money to worthy causes. I'm much more careful with my time. And so we try following some of our financial advisor's advice not to give away more than 4% of our cash flow in any particular month. And so that it doesn't disturb our budget.
Mm-hmm.
That may sound like it doesn't work. It works just fine. And then we give away a lot of other things, partly because we want as little money to go into the corporate state, the empire state, as possible. So we itemize our deductions when it comes to time to do taxes, which is relevant since this is tax time. But anyway, that's how we've come to deal amicably with our differences of personality and also maintaining a budget.
Had you tried some other ways of working out your giving before you came to this arrangement?
No, this has been just an evolving project during our marriage.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how couples, households work this out, work out their money issues. In our professional work, we see this a lot. We all come to the table with a little bit different perspective on money, on like your example of time and money and where those trade-offs are. And it's interesting to see how households work that out. And there's no one right answer for what's going to work. It really is a function of the individuals involved and their priorities and what comes easily to them and what's harder. But all of that's grounded in conversation. We have to be willing to talk about money within our households. It's even hard there. And it's so hard in the larger world among our communities and in our faith communities of talking openly about money and sharing those ideas so you can evolve together towards something that works for more people and that we can work more effectively collectively around our money than we currently do now. Help us move from the, this money is mine, and I will do with it exactly what I please, and more toward this money is ours. This resource is really ultimately the wider community's resource. And how can we collectively work together to see the world that we want to see, to see an economy that works better for more people and better for our planet?
Indeed. Let's move on, Susan, to chapter 6, where you talk about planning grounded in mm-hmm. faith. And in that case, you talk about, for example, wills and legacies.
Right. It's another place that the individual versus the collective really comes into play. We tend to write our wills only concerned about our immediate family. I mean, that's the way we're taught. That's the way the lawyers lead us. You know, that we think of this money as ours, and we want to make sure our kids are okay, and or the other family members that we're leaving this money to. And it's really a place that we could challenge ourselves to think more broadly. I know this is personal confession. After spending most of my adult life working on these issues of money and faith, when my husband and I redid our wills just a few years ago, we only included our kids. And it was only after we got back from the lawyers, it was like, what are we doing? What are we thinking? Because you just don't think of it that way. Now, one way that we have done better, we fixed that, by the way. One way that we have seen our clients really lead on this issue is something that we've called a justice trust, where our clients who had invested in a particular way, had held assets in projects and investments that they really believed in were doing good work in the world, community investments that got capital in the hands of low-income communities, low-income housing, that kind of thing. And they felt very strongly about it. And they actually, you can't, unless you're going to do expensive trusts and that kind of thing, it doesn't tie the hands of the people that you are leaving your money to. Say you're leaving your money to your kids, because you want to make sure they're okay should something happen in their lives that you can't foresee. But these two clients had asked their kids to leave it invested in these community investments, if at all possible. Giving them permission, recognizing that, you know, something terrible could come up and you really need this money, and that's fine. But if you don't just go buy a bigger house. You know, that's not what this money is for. We're asking you to respect that it's doing good work in the world and to leave it there if at all possible. Continue this legacy of justice work with the money. Help us do that. And it led to some very difficult but really rewarding conversations in one household in particular, a way to really help their kids see why they were investing the way they were, the kind of decisions that they'd made, where the motivations came for those decisions, and a mutual respect for in recognizing the continuity of using.
Indeed. In our case, we've written what we call our family mission statement, whereby we outline what's important to us. We share that with our children. We try to get our children to write their version of the family mission statement and then combine them together. Now, you've also mentioned the money autobiography. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, it's a wonderful tool for exploring our own relationship with money, getting a sense of where did we even get these ideas about money that we hold, and to clarify what some of those ideas are. So it delves into questions like the role of money in our childhood, happy memories around money, stressful memories from our childhood around money, what we remember about what the adults in our lives kind of taught us about money, either directly or indirectly modeling. And then, you know, our exploring our feelings around money. Do we feel guilty for what we have? Do we feel inferior for what we don't have, or superior for what, you know, do we worry about money? Do we have a genuine lack of money that makes our life really precarious and that leaves us particularly vulnerable to certain things? And how do we feel about that, and how do we approach the world from that position? So it's those more questions of history and memory and feeling to help explore our relationship with money and where it came from. And that becomes a launching point then for what's my next step in working on, if I'm thinking about questions of money and my values or money and faith, what's my next step in that exploration? And this really helps target an area that that can be productive and fruitful and freeing over time. So it's a great tool. There are several versions of it floating around in the world out there. A Faith and Money Network has one that's been working well for a long time with certain updates over time. And we even have Faith and Money Network even has a supplement for families around what we're teaching our children around money and what values do we want them to have and what memories are we creating for them around money that can that might be of interest to folks who have children in their lives as they work on this for themselves.
We'll return momentarily to our conversation with Susan Taylor, but I want to put in a real plug here for an organization that has impacted me mightily, and their way of thinking. I'm talking here about Faith and Money Network. Susan Taylor, as we mentioned in the biography today, is the vice president of that board. We've also interviewed in a previous podcast Paul Taylor, who's president of that board, and the director is Mike Little, who is a good friend, and I just so appreciate the work he continues to do in Faith and Money Network. So here's my thoughts. This is an organization you really need to know about if you're at all interested in these issues of looking at money differently and how to explicitly connect money with our souls, our emotions, and our expressed faith. And this, you know, ranges the gamut from how we spend, how we invest, how we give, all of that. So, of course, if you haven't purchased this book yet by Susan, What About Our Money? A Faith Response, do it, because that embodies so much of the whole philosophy of the Faith and Money Network. Now, the United Methodist Women, having heard about that network, commissioned Susan to write this book, so you need to order it from them. Just simply unitedmethodistwomen.org/mission-u and then /money. But that address is also written in our notes as well, so you didn't have to copy it down right now. Well, now, then too, look at the Faith and Money Network website, faithandmoney.org. And that'll introduce you further to that organization. I highly recommend it. They're great colleagues with the kind of work we do, both in Simple Living Works and in Jubilee Economics. Well, now let's return to Jerry's conversation with Susan Taylor on giving and investing and connecting faith with both.
Thank you. Let's enter into now talking about what can we change. So this is very much different, very much focused on action.
Right.
And of course, we can change ourselves. That's primarily where we start. For example, we can start by discerning the difference between needs and wants.
Yes. And that's really hard. And it stays hard. We can get better at it over time. But in a world where that's in flux, it can really be difficult to discern what's a need and a want. You know, the things that I think of as needs would be absolute luxuries beyond imagination for my parents or my grandparents. So are they if they have not always existed, are they really a need? And I think, yes, we do have some actual needs beyond our physical sustenance to function in this world that we live in this time that we live in. We still live as companions to our times. And so what do needs look like there? And that requires reflection, and I think ongoing reflection to challenge some preconceptions that we might have and some assumptions that we make, either based on, you know, what our friends have, what we see on TV, what advertising are telling us we need, what our jobs are telling us we need. And I think that's an ongoing conversation within our households and our communities to keep a balance there.
One thing that we encourage is what's called media literacy.
Yeah.
Because so many of our wants and our needs are defined by the media.
Yes.
We're just tempted every day to get things we don't really need. And so do you want to tell us a little bit about media literacy, how you understand it?
From the perspective of faith and money, the media literacy is, I think, a crucial issue because we're so surrounded by it. It shouldn't have as much weight as it has, except that we are surrounded by it all the time. You can't eat out. You can't go to the Y. You can't go anywhere in public life without a television being on somewhere, without media messages from billboards or on our Facebook feed or, you know, just everywhere. And anything that's coming at you 24/7 is hard not to internalize, unless we're consciously pushing back. And for me, this is one of the roles of community, of surrounding ourselves with people who help us live up to our own best intentions. I cannot imagine having raised my kids, for instance, in this over-commercialized world, to have any sense of values and perspective at all on how much is enough, if I had not been involved in a community that were teaching their kids the same things. So there was a different sense of expectation and messaging that I felt like my kids got because of who they were around, who our friends were, who was in our house, who we went to church with, that helped support what we were trying to teach them. That's one of our great tools in pushing back, I think, against the media messages. And here's where denial comes into. Most of us think that, oh, advertising works on other people but not on me. There are actually surveys that, I can't cite specific statistics for you, but there are surveys that show that most people think advertising does not work on them. But I would suggest that a multi-billion dollar industry isn't throwing their money away. They're spending it for advertising because it works. And we need to be honest with ourselves that advertising can work, and it creates pressure in our lives. It creates internal dissonance against what we know in our heart of hearts to be true, that we don't need that, but it creates an internal dissonance around the edges somewhere. I do think I need that. And it's just imperative that we do that work to see the messages for what they are, to be willing to turn the dang things off, turn off the TV, leave off the Facebook feed, and all the places, to really consciously limit our exposure to the extent that it's feasible.
What we do, Susan, is that we record TV programs we want to see, and then we fast forward through the commercials.
Yes.
So it's called zapping. So,
or
the next thing, we
streaming services where you don't. Of course, I pay for that, but at least I don't have to endure the commercials.
The next thing we can change is to vote with our dollars.
Yes, and I really feel strongly about this. For people who literally do not have the resources to, they really don't have sufficient money to do what they need to do to maintain their lives. This is not necessarily a message for them, because that's a whole different kind of pressure. When we talk about voting with our dollars, I have some sensitivity because some people genuinely don't have sufficient money to meet their needs at any price. And sometimes when we're voting with our dollars, it can mean we're paying a little bit of a premium, for example, for fair trade products that participate in a market economy, but in one that's designed well, one that actually supports the people who grow the coffee or cocoa, for instance, instead of participating in the more speculative commodities markets that leave those farmers so vulnerable to global price changes and allow those farmers to create some stability and security in their lives just by the way we choose what kind of products we buy. One of my favorite stories of parenting was when my daughter was about 10 or so, and we were driving past one of the big box stores that advertises always cheaper prices, and I wasn't even paying attention. I was just driving, and I hear my daughter say, "Cheaper for whom?" You know, already she got that sometimes our cheaper prices are at someone else's expense, and often at the planet's expense. And voting with our dollars is a way to say we live in this capitalist economy, but we're going to do it better. We're going to do it differently in a way that really minimizes the damage and perhaps even creates more security for other people that are participating with us in this crazy system.
Well, in your work, you deal a lot with social screens. Tell us a little about positive and negative social screens for those of us who do have some money to invest.
The social investing industry has been around for decades now, creating ways of eliminating companies that people don't want to be invested in. We call those negative screens. So, for instance, if you don't want to be invested in a company that's a big polluter or is producing weapons, or a very common one now is people don't want to participate in the fossil fuel industry anymore, recognizing its impact on climate change, and don't want to be invested in companies that are major contributors to that. So those are negative screens. Then positive screens are the ones saying we do want to be invested in, for instance, alternative energy, the people trying to do business better. We want to be invested in new medical technologies, for instance, that are saving people's lives. That we do want to be invested in low-income housing to make it possible for more people to have secure, affordable housing. That kind of example would be examples of positive screens. Used to, in earlier days of our industry, negative screens were about all you could hope for. Now we have many more options and tools that allow us to implement those positive screens and feel like we're investing in a more constructive way.
Well, I'd like to put in a little pitch here, Susan, for fraternal organizations. We have all of our retirement with Thrivent Financial, formerly for Lutherans, mm-hmm. now for all Christians, and it's a fraternal organization so that all the profits come back to the members, not to the shareholders, but to the members through a whole variety of ways so that we can distribute the profits of the corporation. And I know that you've talked about credit unions and about local banks, you know, and that kind of thing.
Right.
We use Thrivent Federal Credit Union for all of our banking because it's part of Thrivent Financial. So I don't know if you want to get into the difference between fraternal organizations and commercial organizations, but we're very strong supporters of fraternal organizations.
I think that's an excellent example of the way people of values are organizing to do business better. Mennonites have collaborated on their finances for the life of their community as well, of joining forces, essentially, you know, collaborating together and having ways to pool the power of the money that we hold. I often call us, as people of faith, loaves and fishes people, you know, that each one of us may not have enough money to change the world, but if I bring my bit and you bring your bit and we put them together, blessed by God, blessed by the community, it can really make a difference in the world, and fraternal organizations are an excellent example of how that happens. Better banking is another example. You don't have to hate the big banks. Even a lot of people do, but that's not even necessary to feel like, you know, my money in a big bank isn't coming back to my community. But in a community bank or a community credit union, then that money is staying more within my community and creating an economy that works for us here. For people who don't have access to a good community bank, the wonders of internet banking make it possible to invest and bank in institutions regardless of location. One of the tools that my husband and I've used, for instance, is we bank in a community development financial institution in the Southeast. It's not local. For folks who don't have access to a good community bank, the miracles of internet banking make it feasible for us to bank elsewhere. I just am trying to encourage people not to think of all of these things as either or, but both and. You know, we have a local credit union that's not particularly proactive, but we keep a small checking account there so we can make deposits and get cash and so on, those basic banking functions. But the bulk of any money that we would keep in a bank goes to a community development financial institution states away from us, but doing really interesting, proactive, important work in low-income areas in the Southeast. So, and then we just do an electronic transfer between the two institutions when we need to move money back and forth. So we don't have to think of things quite so much in terms of either or. Either we have a perfect bank or we just throw up our hands and bank at one of the mega banks. But we can come up with a hybrid solution perhaps that helps us be more proactive in the world with the money that we have access to. And collectively doing that, I think we can make people of values can make a real difference in the world.
Indeed. Well, I'd like to just bring up the 9 things that you say that we can do, particularly in regard to women's retirement. For example, you say we can reward companies that are great employers for women. Great employers offer such policies as flexible family leave, making it more likely that women will be promoted, well paid, and be able to participate in workplace retirement programs. So I'll just go on, and you stop me if you want to comment on any of these, because I think they're all worth mentioning. We can work for and finance others who work for legislation to compensate women equally to men and to enforce family-friendly workplace regulations. We can advocate for government-funded child care for working families. We can work to preserve the Social Security system, the most effective poverty alleviation program ever implemented in the United States, to ensure that all workers are covered by the program, and to fight against privatization of Social Security that would leave Social Security income more at risk to stock market volatility. We can support regulations on the financial industry that make our stock market investments less vulnerable to the instabilities in and exploitation of our financial institutions and processes. We can support
right.
labor unions that fight for living wages, healthcare benefits, and pensions.
Some of my point with many of these is so often we feel like these factors, things like the gutting of unions over the last 30 years, that was somehow a natural market force when it was a political choice, and that we can participate in efforts to strengthen aspects of the economy that make it where these things work for more people. That's how kind of how I would summarize what a lot of those are getting at. Obviously, no one person can do all of that, be involved in all of those, but there are movements, there are organizations and groups of people working on those issues, and people can find interested folks, committed folks can find a way to engage, to weigh in on the side of an economy that works better for everyone.
Indeed. And I'll just quickly mention the last three. Challenge the elimination of workplace-based pensions and advocate for defined benefit pensions for more members of our society, including within our church. Support universal health care that is not tied to insurance companies so that severe illness will not bankrupt women and families even when they have, quote, coverage. And finally, eliminate loopholes in Medicare that leave retirees with huge medical bills that decimate retirement savings. So thank you for that handy list.
And you could go on and on and on with those factors of ways that our social safety nets have been chipped away at over time. I feel like we have made some social contracts over I'm not sure I would put it that way, that we have decided that together we can provide some supports for people who might have fewer independent resources, and that we've decided together that we want to see a society that educates its children, takes care of the health of its elders, doesn't allow the financial industry to prey on people who are not particularly sophisticated investors. All of those aspects of our economy that I feel like we used to have more of a sense of we are in this together. But in that corruption of our economy, in the corruption of our spirits and hearts, where we have this sense of my money's mine, mine, you know, I don't want to pay my taxes for any of those things. This is my money. I earned it. I want my taxes to be the dead level minimum they have to be. Well, you can't do those things as a society without paying for them, which requires taxation.
This book is available for $10 from United Methodist Women at 800-305-9857 or umwmissionresources.org. Once again, the title is What About Our Money? A Faith Response by Susan K. Taylor. Do you have any more projects in the works that you want to give us a sneak peek?
I'm sure you've seen Ched Meyers' volume, The Biblical Vision of Sabbath Economics. And there was a companion volume put out with that called Household Practices that Presbyterian minister Matt Caldwell prepared. And I'm working with Ched Myers on an update of that Household Practices volume that translates essentially, you know, the biblical vision tells the story of the lessons around money traced through the Bible. Household Practices answers the question, well, what does that mean for us now in this time? And what are the things that we can do in the ways that we live? So we're working on an update of that volume that should be out, I'm hoping, by fall.
Good, good. Well, I'll look forward to getting a copy of that. Will that be for the general public, or will that be for Presbyterian women?
No, that one's general.
And the publisher?
Doesn't have this. It does not have any denominational slant.
And the publisher?
Frankly, I think our path right now is that we're just going to put it out free on PDF format on the website.
Oh, excellent.
Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries website.
Oh, excellent.
They were originally published by Tell the Word Press, which was a small press that periodically raised its head at the Church of the Savior for special projects. But they're not doing that anymore.
I see. Okay.
And a larger publishing house offered, but Ched's really of the opinion that let's just get it out there and make it free.
There you go. So. Wonderful. Well, peace be with you, my friend. I hope we can talk again. Keep up the good work.
You've been listening to another part of our conversation with Susan Taylor on her book, What About Our Money? A Faith Response, a book you'll want to get. And I want to make a few responses of my own to these provocative thoughts, these delectable ideas that Susan shares. First of all, I want to say that a simple thing like choosing a bank is a spiritual practice. Your money talks. Our money talks. Banks, in many cases, I would say the major banks do not speak the same language that Susan Taylor speaks in her book. If you want to speak that language, if we want to speak that language of a different way of thinking about money, we've got to choose a different bank than Wells Fargo. Ugh, I got to admit that that's where my mortgage is right now. It really displeases me. But when they sell mortgages, it's pretty hard to control where they go. Any of the major banks. Find a local bank. Find a credit union. Someone that comes a lot closer to speaking the same language you do, because that's a spiritual discipline. I've written a much longer essay on this idea of choosing a bank as a spiritual practice. You can find it, by the way, on the Faith and Money Network website, which was pleased to publish it. Then I want to say a word about taxes. There's such a strong narrative in the U.S. that taxes are bad, that taxes are something we should have less of. And it isn't necessarily so. Taxes, as Adam Smith, one of the God figures of capitalism, emphasized that taxes were a kind of honor, because he recognized that capitalism has many gaps, many things it can't do well, and that without a form of taxation, taxation was a form of redistribution for the things that capitalism's normal way of practice, of growth in investments, it couldn't perform many social functions that were needed. So taxes were to do that. Now, to be sure, tax structures get terribly, terribly skewed, and I do not like that so many of our taxes go, for example, to defense. So like about half of the whole money collected by the federal government go to exorbitant expenses in military worldwide, you know, that are just offensive to me. But whether it's sales tax, taxes aren't necessarily our enemy. And as someone in the Scandinavian countries I heard recently said, you know, someone said, well, you have a lot of taxes. He says, yes, we do. And he said, don't you resent that? He says, no, because they're investments. They give us health care. They give us education. And he named a whole lot more. So as we think about money, as we think about our taxes, as we think about, you know, the systems and structures that we work with, let's simply not accept the narrative that taxes are bad. Only some taxes are bad, and we have to learn discernment about that. And then I just want to say a word about redistribution. Taxation is one way it's done, but we can also redistribute through our giving. Redistribution is a practice of Jubilee, and here I'm not talking about redistribution upward, because that's what capitalism does very well, and many tax systems do it very well. They move the money from those with less to those with more, and those with more don't invest their share. I'm talking here about redistribution downward and outward, and Jubilee engages in this kind of redistribution. Every month, we are part of redistribution to groups in Mexico where the economy functions very differently. And so those of us who are at this well where we drink a lot can redistribute to those with less. And it's a profound Jubilee function, and it's something that we're learning about more and more all the time. And then I want to say, too, that one of the big issues today is how money impacts women. Women clearly are not the recipients of the amount of money that men are for the same amount of work. So there's a huge disparity there. Because Jubilee Economics works a lot with Mexico, we have a lot of interest in how women are being empowered in Mexico today. And there again, we have lots of examples of this. There's a group of artists, Artesanas Shalom, and who are starting their own business now and having an income stream as women. There's a women's collective where women have come together with their businesses, small businesses, and are creating products again to that empowers them to have an income flow. There's a whole lot of emphasis going on in the San Mateo Jubilee Circle on women's legal rights. So important. In San Cristobal, we recently helped some indigenous artists, mostly women, get a new sewing machine to empower their important artistry industry in creating clothing and scarves and textile items that carry their culture and bring their culture into the marketplace. And then there's a whole emphasis on communitarian feminism, a very cutting-edge type of feminism, feminista comunitario, that is being taught in San Cristobal. All of these things can be supported through donations to Jubilee Economics, and that just really thrills me that we can redistribute this way and empower women in our two countries, Mexico and the U.S. So, oh, that was kind of a lot, Jerry, so I went on a good bit, but help us bring this episode to conclusion, if you would, please. Thank you.
Would you like to make a donation to the Common Good Podcast? Just click on the Donate button on the CasaJubileo.org website. That's CasaJubileo.org, Casa Jubileo. Jubilee is a mostly volunteer 501c3 nonprofit organization, so your donations are tax-deductible. When you donate, if you ask for a copy of the little mini-book on the forming powerful little Jubilee circles, we'll send you one. Circles help us beneficially radicalize our work for change. Donate $50 or more all at once or in quarterly payments and receive upon request an autographed copy of Lee's book, From Egos to Eden, Our Heroic Journey to Keep Earth Livable, released in 2017.
By donating, you'll know that in this time of crisis, you're making a difference. I've made some significant changes to Simple Living Works for 2018. The weekly digest has been discontinued, though the monthly digest of links to articles on colleague sites continues on the Simple Living Works site and is updated weekly. The Simpler Living Weekly Nudge and the Daily Nudge both continue. Subscribe to My Simpler Daily Nudge to get quick reminders of Lee's blogs, the Common Good podcast, Simple Living Works podcast, and other intriguing happenings and events, such as Nonconform Freely celebrations, ways to honor rites of passage and holidays without consumerism. Well, please tell us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on the Common Good podcast or Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Time to wrap up this episode of Simpler One Earth Living podcast. If you're a regular listener, you've heard our closing comments, so we'll say goodbye now. But if you're a newer listener, here's what we'd like to know about the podcast. Please subscribe to our podcast and to our Jubilee Economics and One Earth blogs. We post nearly every week, so if you're a subscriber, you'll be notified when we post something new. Subscriptions are free. Subscribe to our blog through our website. Subscribe to the Common Good podcast or Simple Living Works at iTunes or your favorite podcast service. Urge your friends to do the same. Have you liked us on Facebook yet? Well, please do, and leave us a message. We don't hear from you nearly enough. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of the One Earth Project, wishing you well as we strive together to bring One Earth economics into being for the common good.
Learn to live simply so others can live.